abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Thursday, December 19th, 2013. I've just returned from being out of town for several days, and I knew that I was going to be too exhausted to do the program today. So what I've got for you is a speech of mine that I'm pretty happy with and not that many people had a chance to hear, just because I didn't really promote it very much, and it just kind of languished out there on YouTube, but I think you'll like it. It's a speech I gave to the State Convention of Young Americans for Liberty here in Kansas, the state where I reside. It was extremely strange that the mayor of Manhattan, Kansas, where Kansas State University is, where we had this event, was in attendance for my talk specifically because he said he wanted to hear me, that he read my books, he was a fan, and we got my picture taken with him and my daughter, and I said, "Do I get the key to the city?" And he was a little bit murky about whether that was going to happen, but this was a nice event. I think you'll like the speech. Don't forget, 35% off libertyclassroom.com for the people on your gift list this year. That's available only at libertyclassroom.com/secret. This is where they can learn real history, economics, philosophy while driving in their cars. But you get a special deal as a listener to this program. Nobody else knows about libertyclassroom.com/secret. And remember, you can keep the lights on for us by entering Amazon via the widget at tomwoodsradio.com. And now, with no further ado, here's Tom Woods.
This is a long, narrow room. Isn't it? Strange. Okay. All right, let's do this. I'm very glad to be here. I live in Topeka. I live like less than an hour from you people. How come nobody visits? I'm dying out there in Topeka. There's like two guys who are sympathetic to me out there in Topeka. So, whereas you guys have like the mayor out here, so I don't know what's going on. Totally lopsided. But please do come seek me out and visit me in Topeka so I don't lose heart entirely. But I'm very glad to say that we have four girls, my wife and I, and one of my four girls, who probably didn't want me to say this, but too late, is here with us. It's my almost 10-year-old Regina Woods came with me today. And I tell lots of stories about her. And so if you watch a lot of my YouTubes, this is Regina. This is a kid who knows all about the Fed and everything that I did. It's great. All right, well, what I'm going to do tonight is talk a little bit about, after you've had this workshop stuff during the day, give a big picture overview of the significance of what we've accomplished and are going to continue to accomplish. Because it is easy to get discouraged and ground down by events, but as somebody who's a little bit older than some of you, I can assure you that we have made substantial strides. And it's not always in legislation, sometimes it is, but in changing the conversation in the U.S., there's no question that we have made bigger strides than I could have dreamed possible even 10 years ago. And so I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about who we are specifically, because we don't really fit into any of into the holes. I mean, we're talking about a round hole and a square peg. That's what we are. Because everybody wants to fit you into either the Democrats or the Republicans, or the liberals or the conservatives. And, you know, sometimes you feel sympathetic to one of those groups, and sometimes you feel sympathetic to the other, and sometimes you feel like they're all completely insane. And that's sort of who we are. Now, you guys have advantages in spreading these ideas that I didn't have 20 years ago. Now, 20 years ago, or a little longer than 20 years ago, like around 1990, that's when I graduated from high school. And I went off to college, I went to Harvard, and this was an experience, because I came from a conservative town in Massachusetts, and I know you're thinking there is no such thing as a conservative. The conservative town in Massachusetts votes for Obama, and the liberal town votes for the Marxist candidate. But there really, well, we really did have a conservative little town, North Andover. This was the town where every time John Kerry came up for re-election, our town voted for the other guy. It didn't matter if the guy was dead, he was a crook, he was a dead crook. It didn't matter. We voted for him, didn't vote for the other guy. So we had this conservative little town. Then I go off to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And these are like the craziest people I have ever seen. And they're not crazy like they're crazy over there and I'm doing my studies over here. They insist on being crazy like right in front of me every day. So I would go to the dining hall every day, freshman year, over at the, they don't do this anymore, they have a different building, the Freshman Union. And every day, the Workers' Vanguard newspaper was being sold up there. Now, this is a commie newspaper. These are real-life communists in 1990. And normal people would just walk right on by them, go into the dining hall and eat dinner. I can't do that. I got to address these people. Like, you people are communists? In the year, like, what is this, 1953? How can you be communists? What's the matter with you people? So I would have to engage them. I just couldn't help myself. And so I would, because I would think maybe they just don't have enough knowledge, right? They just don't know all the bad things the commies did. So I'll get there and talk to them. And it just wasn't working. So I thought, the problem must be with me. I don't have enough knowledge. So I started reading and learning more history just so I could debate the communists in front of the dining hall. Like, I just couldn't allow error to go unrefuted. But the more history I read, the more I realized I liked history. I mean, this actually got me really interested in history to the point where it became my major. Before that, I was actually considering being a math major. I believe that. Think how different my life would have been as a math major, but thanks to the communists, bring them to history. So that had an effect on me. And then I came to the conclusion, though, that whatever these crazy people in Cambridge are, I think I want to be the exact opposite. And so I began to think to myself, well, I pretty much favor the free market economy. I favor all these certain things. Thanks to my father. My father was a blue-collar worker. He worked as a forklift operator in a food warehouse for many years. And he was basically like one of your regular pro-Reagan conservatives, you know, blue-collar conservative types. And so he taught me some of the basics. He wasn't right on everything, but he got me on the right track. I can hardly bear to think of where I would have been if it weren't for this man. I mean, I could very easily have wound up a left-winger. I would have been horrifying. But he got me on the right track. But not, you know, he wasn't 100% ideologically pure. He was just a regular guy with some common sense. But the commie experience made me think I have to sharpen and hone my beliefs. Because I came to the conclusion that if I believe in the free market economy, then I should just believe it. And quit making exceptions. Well, we need more spending on this, and maybe we need this regulation. Look, if the free market is right, I'm going to figure out how it can work purely. I want to be that guy. And just, I want to be consistent. And so I found a little flyer about a seminar put on by the Institute for Humane Studies. And they've got a representative here. So I went to their week-long seminar in 1992, and it just blew me away. It changed my mind on so many things. I thought I was like some real free market, whatever. And I walked away from that thinking I'm some pathetic interventionist statist bum compared to these guys. And it was an incredible experience. I thoroughly enjoyed that. And so the next year, I saw another ad. This is like before the internet. I saw an ad in a magazine, so I wrote away for their brochure. To the Mises Institute. I went to their Mises University summer program, and so I became convinced of the Austrian School of Economics. But this was hard for me to finally get to where you guys all are now. Like, you guys, it amazes me how quick it is, I mean, how short the learning curve is. I mean, you guys get into college, and you're freshmen, and maybe you don't know a whole lot about this stuff. And then in like 3 months, you're like the world's expert on everything. And you've rooted out any ideological inconsistency in your worldview. And it amazes me, but part of the reason is you have an advantage that I didn't have. For one thing, you're living in a world where there are a lot more people who hold these pro-freedom views than there were 20, 25 years ago. So you have a lot more people you can reach out to who can connect you with this, who can guide you through it, be your mentors through it. But the other thing, of course, is you have the internet, and I didn't. And when I was younger, I used to get a kick out of my grandparents who would say, in my day, we didn't have television. And I would think, wow, what a horrible life you must have had. And I would think to myself, well, I'll never have to say that to my kids because it's 1990 and everything's already been invented. So now I have children who can't imagine that I lived in a world with no Google. Like, if I needed to learn something, I had to get in the car and drive to the library. I mean, what kind of horrible dystopia did you live in? But it means that you can sit there, and with one website, you can come upon these ideas and learn and learn, you know, and have three sleepless nights where you just absorb it all. And then on the other side of that, you come out and say, yes. That was it. I mean, even if you have no friends, you can go on YouTube and kind of feel like you have a friend. Somebody's talking to you. So you guys have advantages. And what I'm suggesting that we do is take these advantages and build upon what we've accomplished. What have we accomplished and who are we? Well, Ron Paul had this book that came out in 2008. It was called The Revolution, A Manifesto. Now, that book has been translated into a number of other languages. But the idea of the Ron Paul revolution doesn't translate so well to other languages because people in other countries are not as familiar with that term. So when the Italian translation of that book came out, they renamed it in Italian, The Third America. And I thought, wow, a translator who actually got the book. That's exactly what that book is. That's exactly what Ron Paul is. That the idea of the Third America is that you've got two Americas that are rammed down our throats and we see on MSNBC and Fox News and CNN 24 hours a day. You've got Barack Obama and you've got John McCain. And that exhausts your options. And whereas Ron Paul's view was, you know, I'm pretty sure there are other opinions out there other than those. And that's what the Third America is. And that's who we are. We are the alternative. It's not that John McCain was the alternative to Barack Obama. In fact, it's like he was anticipating this speech, because just the other day, McCain was quoted as saying in a speech, he said, you know, I have a lot of differences with Barack Obama, but on foreign policy, it turns out I agree with him a whole lot more than I do with, you know, he means like Rand Paul and people in the party right now. And I thought, well, you don't say. So my blog post about this at tomwoods.com was McCain and Obama sitting in a tree. You know, that's what's going on here. So we get this one America, basically, is really weird. So we are the alternative. That's who we are. So what I want to talk about tonight are the three areas that I think are the most significant, where if it hadn't been for us, there would have been no debate at all. You know, there was a review of Dr. Paul's book by Publishers Weekly, and they said, Ron Paul gives new life to old debates. But that's not quite right. It's that if it weren't for Ron Paul, there would be no debate. On foreign policy, there would be no debate, or the debate would be, do we starve these people first, or do we just bomb them right away? Like, that's usually the debate. Or the economic debate, do we bail out this one, or both? Like, those would be the debates. Right? Does the federal government order the states to do A or B? Like, that's the big debate. What kind of crummy debates are these? No matter who wins, it's terrible. It doesn't matter. So let's start off. First thing is on the economy. Now, you guys have lived through a historic event, namely the panic of 2008. It's absolutely historic. I mean, people will be talking about this for a long time. And when that occurred, and when all respectable opinion was demanding the whole slew of bailouts that we wound up getting, you had a small cadre of people saying, no, this is a bad idea. And that small cadre of people basically was our people. It's true you had some left-wing people who were against the bailouts, but by and large, it was our people. And even the left-wing people who were against the bailouts, they had a completely false understanding of what had caused the problem, of capitalism caused the problem. Capitalism caused the problem. The unregulated banking sector, which is the most heavily regulated sector in the whole economy. There were at the time 115 state and federal institutions given the task of regulating the financial sector. This is deregulation, by the way. We spend more on financial regulation, three times more in real terms, adjusting for inflation, than was spent in 1980. But it's deregulation, whatever. It was our people who were trying to put things right. And you would think the conservatives would be reliable on this, right? They're always talking free markets and small government. And yet, what do we get? You know what? I'm going to name names. You know, screw it. I'm going to name names. Herman Cain, for heaven's sake, is lecturing people and saying that we can't have free market purists at a time like this. Purists are the one, because you don't want to just shovel money at some of the worst, most rotten institutions in the whole economy. You're some kind of purist. We can't have that. This is a guy who, by the way, not coincidentally, 1 week before the wheels really came off, in September of 2008, he's still saying there's not a thing wrong that he can see with the economy, and anybody who complains about it is probably some anti-Republican media hack. You know, just unbelievable. So absolutely incapable of perceiving any such problem. The 2008 Republican nominee said, admitted, look, I don't know that much about economics, but I've got Alan Greenspan's book. Well, what am I to say to that? I mean, it was our people. If it hadn't been for our people, there would have been no discussion. It would have been, I mean, we had George W. Bush saying, I had to violate free market principles to save the free market. You know, that's just one in a series of inanities that we lived with for 8 years. If it hadn't been for us, there would have been no debate. And yet we had, for years, we had so-called free market people who were not uttering a peep about the Fed. Not one peep, nothing. They could see nothing wrong with the dot-com boom and the housing boom and the Fed's policies. Nothing. And yet we now know that what the Fed was engaged in under Alan Greenspan was ginning up what's called the wealth effect. And what this means is the Fed was trying to raise stock prices so that the wealthy would look at their stock portfolios and say, wow, I'm getting wealthier and wealthier. Look at my stock portfolio. And that would make them want to spend and borrow more. And that would stimulate economic activity. Now, that obviously is economic planning. That is not the free market. But that's what the Fed was engaged in. Gin up the stock market, to gin up economic activity, to make the numbers look good. Forget about the actual health of the real economy. The numbers look great. Now, this wealth effect strategy encourages the bailout mentality, because then if anything happens in the economy that threatens to bring stock prices down, it's going to undermine the wealth effect. So therefore, we've got to get those prices back up. We've got to bail out and bail out, and that's what we wound up getting. No, to the contrary, not only do we get no criticism of Greenspan, we had, by and large, adulation. In fact, I mean, this is a guy who, when he was, I think it was 60 Minutes, some major interviewer interviewed him just about a year ago and played Greenspan a clip from his testimony before Congress, just a clip at random. And this clip is of Greenspan blah, 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 about stuff no one can understand. It makes absolutely no sense. It's just gibberish. And the congressmen are all nodding their heads. Oh, okay, yep, whatever you say. This guy's great. And so this interviewer actually said, you know, what did that mean? That clip of yours we just heard, tell us what that meant. And he kind of chuckled and said, well, you know, sometimes I engaged in, and he called it syntax destruction. He even has a term for it, where he pulls the wool over the eyes of Congress by assuming that they're not all super knowledgeable about monetary policy. And I'll grant him, that's a safe assumption. So he can just blah, 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 using words that don't make sense when juxtaposed against one another. And no one catches this till years later. I sometimes have told the story about the New Republic magazine. Now, some of you are so into the internet age, you've never even heard of the New Republic magazine. Ah, the glories of living in 2013, and young people have never even heard of the New Republic. But it's a horrible magazine. It's been around for about 100 years. It was just as horrible then as it is now. And they had a writer in the early 90s named Stephen Glass, late 80s, early 90s. And Glass used to break all, well, I didn't mean that as a pun, Glass was, I'm sorry. He used to break all these stories, and these other reporters would be jealous of him. How did he get that story? Well, the answer is he made up these stories. He would just make up these, and they were fascinating, but you could get away with that before the internet. And then when people started Googling these things, nothing's coming up, they caught him. They made a whole movie about this. It's a really great movie. Anyway, so he had a story about Alan Greenspan, and his story was that he said that investors constructed a little shrine to Greenspan with his image and flowers, and they would all sit in front of it and meditate on Wall Street. Now, that's a phony story. But nobody noticed that it was phony. At the time, people thought, that sounds like something people might want to do. Let's all get together cross-legged with our incense in front of an image of Alan Greenspan. I mean, this is going on, not a peep from the free market people. Now, of course, not that the left was any better. I saw Rachel Maddow on some of those late-night talk shows saying that if it hadn't been for the bailouts, and I'm not making up any of this, she said, we wouldn't have had an economy. I mean, like, what could that mean? No one would be exchanging things anymore. What is that? Everywhere. And so it was, we were the people who had to go around and say, this was not caused by the free market. It was caused by the Fed and all these other interventions, and here's why. And so this actually built up our profile. People had to look to Peter Schiff to get answers, because they weren't getting answers from the neocons. The typical neocon, what does he know about the Fed? Well, it makes the wars go, I guess, so it's all right. But nobody looks to the neocons for expertise in this area. And so when my own book, Meltdown, came out in 2009, it was a very, very big seller. But it wasn't a big seller just because all the Ron Paul people were buying it. That wouldn't have been enough in that case. It was because there was no alternative. Where were these people's books? There was nothing for months, nothing from the neocons. And so this meant that we were able to distinguish ourselves. So I was able to get on major right-wing radio and TV and talk about abolishing the Fed. Because, well, who else were they going to have on? So this is good. It's good that we actually stood out from the crowd. Well, another guy who's standing out from the crowd, who belongs to this Third America, is the great David Stockman. Now, I'm sure you've been hearing about the eventful month he's had since his book came out. It's really just a few weeks. David Stockman, of course, was the budget director under Ronald Reagan, and he's gotten a lot better even since then. But his book, The Great Deformation, I strongly urge you to read this book. And you're going to go look at that book, and you're going to say, Woods, that book is 700 pages, and I'm a student, and you've got to be out of your freaking mind if you think I'm going to get through this. But you know what? Just take my word for it. And look, when I have my book table, I'm hoping to sell some of my books to you people later today. And yet here I am promoting another book, so you know it must be good. I'm promoting someone else's book. The Great Deformation is one of these books that it's 700 pages, you don't even notice them going by. You just turn the page. Not only because of what he doesn't just cover the bailouts, which he destroys all the arguments for the bailouts. They are in tatters. Nothing. There's not a shred. In fact, if there's one shred of an argument left, you think, well, there's still one shred of an argument. You turn the page and you see he's got a bat and he's bashing it, you know, like it's twitching a little bit, bang, bang, gone. It is incredible. But beyond that, he talks about the warfare state, the development of that. He has a whole revisionist view of the New Deal that is not just the stuff you read in my stuff and in DiLorenzo. It's all fresh new stuff. It's about the economy now and the phoniness of the recovery and all this. Absolutely great. And the prose style is so engaging and punchy. Punchy is the right word. Because it feels like there's a fist coming like right, but not punching you. He's trying to find like, you know, where's John Mack or like whatever. Like, where are these people? Where's Hank Paulson? So just be careful where you open it, right? Open it at the right spot. But Stockman in there, for example, he says, the bailout of AIG, which was very high profile, everybody knew about this. Months later, the CEO of AIG said, you know what, maybe we should have allowed AIG just to go bankrupt. Now, we were all called stupid Neanderthals who don't understand the economy for saying that. And now, like, the actual guy came out and said it. But Stockman then goes through and explains why the problems of the AIG would have been entirely confined to Wall Street. They would have fizzled out right there. 90% of AIG was solvent. And he says that the claim that we were just trying to save the Main Street banks, he said, this is just phony. Basically, almost none of AIG's busted credit default swap liabilities were held by Main Street banks. They were basically held by about a dozen institutions. These dozen institutions would have taken the hit, and then they could have absorbed it because these dozen institutions held about $20 trillion in assets, and they were facing $60 billion in losses. This is a drop in the bucket. This is a few months' worth of bonuses that they preserved by having the bailout. But no, people, we don't even have time to talk to you about this because it's such an emergency. We must immediately rush in. Obama and McCain had to suspend their campaign so they could hurry back and figure out what was going on. And it turns out, so did anybody even bother to look? Like, who's exposed to this? No time. Well, maybe we should have some time, right? Doesn't it seem like all these major things go on with citizen, we just don't have time to look into it? You get the sense that they're afraid that if we did take some time to look into it, we wouldn't agree with them. So therefore, we don't have any time. What about money market mutual funds were collapsing, right? Because the Reserve Prime Fund broke the buck, so it went below $1 a share. It means the world is ending. People are taking their money out and putting it under their mattresses, and this is terrible. But actually, overwhelmingly, people were just moving their money from riskier money markets to safer ones. And then people who did on net withdraw basically put their money right back into the banking system in CDs and savings accounts and stuff. So this too, but no time, major bailout and all that. Well, then also, the CEO of Morgan Stanley, John Mack, he's all upset because people are shorting his stock. How dare people do this? I'm being attacked by the short sellers. No, you're being attacked by your clients who are withdrawing their money. And you deserve it for, you know, being a knucklehead, basically. And so what he did was he gets on the phone, he says the short sellers are gonna destroy the whole economy, you know, it's the usual thing. So the U.S. government then said for 15 days, you can buy all the financial company stock you want, but you're not allowed to sell it. But there's no free market entity that could carry out a regulation like that. So this was clearly a case of, we're just going to prop up the people at the top. That's what it was. There's no, all this stuff about the ATMs are going to go dark and companies can't meet payroll, all of it's a load of you know what. And incidentally, what after all this manipulation and money creation and lower interest rates artificially and all this stuff, what does it have to show for itself? Look at the years 2000 to 2007. Housing bubble is revved up and the economy seems like it's going great. But what was the net number of breadwinner jobs created? Zero. Zero. That's what they have to show for themselves. Who's talking about this except us, right? No one. No one. Because we are the third America. The others are arguing about who gets what kind of bailout. That's the debate. It's this little area of debate that we're allowed to have. And we are like over here talking. And then, but you know, the TV channels want us to talk in here. Well, who should get what type of, you know, it's like, I remember toward the end of the primary season in 2008, there were just four candidates left. It was McCain, Romney, Huckabee, and Ron Paul. And so they had one final debate, and they're just sitting around a table. And all night, it's just Romney and McCain arguing about who's gonna withdraw how many troops from Afghanistan on what timetable. And it's like, well, I'm going to withdraw 10,000 in 10 years. Oh, yeah, well, I thought the other day you said it was 9,000 in 9.5 years. And there's back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then finally Ron Paul said, what the heck is the point of this debate? It's all about who's going to make what trivial change when. And then after the debate was over, they go to establishment man David Gergen. David, what did you think was the highlight of the debate? Well, I think it was when Romney and McCain argued with each other about who's going to withdraw how many troops over there. Obviously, the highlight was when Ron Paul said, hello, this is the stupidest debate in the history of mankind. All right, so the second thing I want to talk to you about, where again, we're the only people doing it. And yet, sometimes we feel discouraged, there aren't enough of us. We are carrying this whole thing on our shoulders. There is nobody other than us doing it, and it's happening. And that's this state nullification issue, where now people are interested in this idea of nullifying unconstitutional federal laws at the state level. Now, there's nobody in respectable right-wingia who's calling for this, right? I mean, the Heritage Foundation is dead set against it. I mean, I don't want to name any more names than that. I'll just name them and leave it there. But by and large, they are dead set against this. All the staff, they're just telling us, wait for the courts to fix everything, citizen, and everything will be okay. Well, I'd like to know how many more centuries do we have to wait on that strategy? Just wondering, right? I mean, when is this going to bear some fruit? Or or they'll claim, well, we don't think this is likely to work. This from people who have had nothing but failures for 100 years, right? I mean, let's be honest with ourselves, right? I mean, you could have a book called Great Conservative Successes. It would be the world's shortest book. It would be one of these gag books full of blank pages. You know, like, they have repealed nothing. They have done nothing. So I'm not going to be lectured to by these people about successes and failures. You know what? Let's just try something else. What could it possibly hurt? Now, you guys probably, you know, you guys are well-informed, so I don't need to give you a huge spiel on this, but I happen to have a little bit invested in this subject because I wrote a book called Nullification. And I explained it one day to Regina when she was only 7. She was 7, and she's dying to read my books, you know, but 7, you got to be a little older, you know, so, but God love her for wanting to know what I'm doing. So I sat her down and I just explained it this way. I said, well, we have this Constitution, and the point of it is to limit what the federal government can do. And so in there, there's a list. There's a list of things that they are allowed to do. And without my even prompting her, she said, well, what if they do something that's not on that list? Yes! She's great. I don't even have to tell her what the right question to ask is. And I said, well, that's what nullification is for. That's when the states say, now, wait a minute, we never gave you the power to do this, so you're just going to have to stop. And she just was amazed that anyone could have any disagreement with this, right? This just seems like common sense to her. So I love that. That's just beautiful. So on this subject, this is getting a lot of traction now. I mean, like now you're hearing, in Topeka, just the other day, we're reading that in the Capitol, the state, the governor signed a Second Amendment preservation bill to protect the Second Amendment, using the state government to stop any incursions on the Second Amendment. This is astonishing that this would happen. And these sorts of bills are going on all over the country with all different types of issues at stake. And now people are sort of interested in this, thinking, well, what could it hurt to try this? We've tried everything else. We've handed out pocket constitutions to our congressmen. We've done all this stuff. Why don't we just see what would happen if we just finally said, you know what? No. No. You just can't do this. You know you can't do this. And you know that we know you can't do this. So we're not going to let you do it. Now, where does this come from? Now, again, I know that in this age of YouTube, there are pluses and minuses with YouTube. The plus is spreading knowledge. I know, most of the time YouTube is used for cute cats and stuff like that. Other than the cute cats, it's used for spreading knowledge. But on the other hand, it means that, you know, half of you guys already know my nullification spiel because you watch it on YouTube. But for the sake of completeness, I want to just take a few minutes on this, because the point of raising it is to show the argument for it is actually really strong. On all different grounds, it's really strong. It's at least strong enough to be worthy of a hearing. And we're not even allowed to talk about it. Because if we do talk about it, you know, the two other Americas don't even bother to refute us. You notice that? They don't even bother. They just say, oh, he's one of those people. You know, he's with Ron Paul, so that's not respectable. Or he's, you know, they don't even have to. All they have to do is just say, wait a minute, he is not on the 3x5 card of approved opinion. So therefore, we don't even need to answer him. Right? He's an un-person. He doesn't exist. They don't even answer us because we're not supposed to talk about it in the first place. But of course we can see strategically, morally, what the argument is, right? If the federal government doesn't have the authority to do something, well, it shouldn't do it. Secondly, most of the things it's doing, whether it has the authority to do them or not, are pretty terrible. So my view is whatever one of them we can stop, why don't we just go ahead and do that? Like, just give that a shot. But the constitutional case, I think, is actually a pretty strong one. And some people will say, well, who cares if it's constitutional or not? The point is, it's the right thing to do. I agree with that. What ultimately matters is it the right thing to do or not? But I like to win arguments on every conceivable ground. And so I want to win it on the constitutional grounds. You can do that. People will say, well, now, wait a minute, Mr. Smarty Pants. I don't see any nullification clause in the Constitution. Where are you going to pull that out of? Or they'll say, the Constitution says that federal law trumps state law. So there goes your little theory. All right, well, I'm going to answer these. And the answer basically runs like this. First of all, it was Thomas Jefferson who came up with this idea. He really codified it into the form that we know it as from 1798. And presumably Jefferson had read the Constitution, knew there was a supremacy clause in it. But the supremacy clause says that, and I'm paraphrasing here, that this Constitution plus laws which shall be made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. So notice it does not say this Constitution plus laws which shall be made in pursuance thereof plus any old laws that we might want to pass shall be the supreme law of the land. It doesn't say that. No one in his right mind would have voted for that. So the point is that it begs the question to say the Supremacy Clause deals with nullification. Because nullification is not dealing with constitutional laws. A nullifier would say a constitutional law is indeed the supreme law of the land. But what if it's not? That's the point. Just flashing around the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution doesn't address this. Okay, that's fine, but what happens when it's unconstitutional? What do we do about that law? Now, the other thing is about the Constitution. Well, there are two ways of demonstrating the constitutionality of nullification. The first way is from the Virginia Ratifying Convention, the most important of the ratifying conventions, arguably. And this is where Madison says, he says in the Federalist Papers, that if you want to know what the Constitution means, you go to the ratifying conventions. Notice he doesn't say you refer to the notes from the Philadelphia Convention of 1787, because no one had access to those notes. Madison's notes did not become available to the general public for decades afterward. That was a closed-door meeting. Nobody had access to that. So you don't look there. You look to what did the peoples of the states agree to? What were they led to believe the Constitution meant? And so at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, it turns out that there was a five-man commission whose job it was to draw up the document by which Virginia would ratify the Constitution. And they were going to tell the world, this is what the Constitution means from Virginia's perspective. This is the meaning of our joining this union. And what's significant about this is that at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, when skeptics like Patrick Henry warned that this would be an unlimited government, he was rebuked by people on this commission. He was rebuked by Edmund Randolph, the governor of Virginia, who became the first Attorney General of the U.S., who said, no, 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 this is a government that's only going to have the powers expressly delegated to it. So it was not the anti-Federalist opponents of the Constitution. It was the Federalist supporters at the ratifying convention that said, this government will have only the powers expressly delegated. They used that phrase, expressly delegated. We didn't make that up later. They used that phrase. Friends of the Constitution used that phrase. And then another person on this commission said, this was George Nicholas, the first Attorney General of Kentucky, said that if Virginia is required by the federal government to agree to any additional powers beyond the ones we've given the federal government, if they impose on us any additional condition, Virginia will be exonerated. Well, exonerated, well, that's like nullification, that's it. Now, these two people, again, these are not just a couple of drunks who stumbled into the convention. These people are on the committee whose job it is to explain to the world what Virginia thinks it's doing when it enters the Union. And it thinks it's entering an expressly limited government that if it jumps beyond those limits, Virginia will be exonerated. And so Jefferson then is just building on this in 1798. He's not inventing some new doctrine. So I put that's in my old nullification book, but it's not in many textbooks. And yet there it is. I mean, you can see the records of the Virginia Ratifying Convention. They're sitting there collecting dust on a library shelf. But the other way you prove it is just look at what the framers did. Actions speak louder than words. I don't care that you can find me three quotations from some guy 30 years later saying such and such. Actions speak louder than words. What was actually done? And the point of this discussion is this. The states came before the federal government. They were there before there was a federal government. They were sovereigns. The peoples of those states were the sovereigns. And if the peoples of the states can be proven to be the sovereigns, then they remain the sovereigns. Sovereignty is not alienable. You stay sovereign once you're sovereign. If they were sovereign, they're still sovereign. And if they're still sovereign, that means that in the last resort, they cannot ultimately be told what to do by an agent they themselves created. Yes, the courts have their role. But in the last resort, as Madison said in his report of 1800, the parties to the Constitution, the states, need to have some way to protect themselves against incursions by an institution they themselves created. Now, how do we prove this? Well, just look at what the states did. Look at what they were doing. In the mid-1770s, Massachusetts and Connecticut and South Carolina were outfitting ships to cruise against the British. That's an exercise of sovereignty. It's an act of war. It was the troops of Connecticut that took Ticonderoga. In New Hampshire, the executive was given the authority to issue letters of marque and reprisal. In 1776, when the laws on treason were drawn up, it was decided that treason would be conceived of as a crime committed against the states slash colonies individually, not as against a single law. The Declaration of Independence acknowledges the free and independent states. And of course, in the diplomatic language of the 18th century, states did not mean what we think of, Massachusetts and Vermont and Kansas. States meant France and Spain. That's what a state was. That's what these states were. And their independence was acknowledged by name individually in the treaty that ended that war. In the Articles of Confederation, Article 2 says the states shall states retain their sovereignty, freedom, and independence. How could they retain something unless they had it in the first place? In the Constitution, we see that the states are represented in many ways, but in particular, the Constitution refers to the United States only in the plural, never as one blob, to emphasize that what makes the United States unique is that it's a collection. It's a collection of societies. So this goes to show the states are out there, the peoples of the states are exercising sovereignty. They're demonstrating that they possess these attributes of sovereignty. And so in the last resort, when high matters of sovereignty have to be dealt with, and the question of does the federal government have a disputed power or not, who are the ultimate deciders, as it were? Well, it's true that the courts have a role, but as Madison said, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, our system does not say that the executive branch is fallible, the legislative branch is fallible, but our judges are divine. The judges can betray you too. And so in the last resort, it is metaphysically impossible that the states who created this institution could, in the last resort, have their hands completely tied. In that last resort, they say, no, we created you, we never gave you this authority. Nobody enters into an agreement and says, only the other party can interpret what this agreement means. No one would do that. No recording artist would enter into a contract with Columbia Records and say, Columbia Records gets to interpret the contract, but not me. Only an idiot would do this. But that's what we're being expected to believe is the case in the United States. But if the federal government has a monopoly on interpreting the Constitution, it will interpret it in its own favor. The point is, this is not an absurd thing I've just told you. I mean, people could disagree with it, but it's not preposterous. There's at least some argument to be made for it. And yet, we're the only ones making it. And it's spreading. A lot of these Tea Party groups are very interested in this, very interested. But they're not hearing about this from Sean Hannity. They're not hearing about it from Rush Limbaugh, unless Walter Williams is filling it. Then they get one respite. But they're not hearing about it from Mark Levin or any, a whole lot of them, not a word, nothing. Nothing. Radio silence. But somehow the word is getting out there, and it's because somehow we're doing this. And people who are interested in this have to go to us, once again, because they're not getting it in National Review. It's being ridiculed in National Review. They're not getting it in the Weekly Standard. Where are they getting it? They're getting it from us. They're going to the 10th Amendment Center, Michael Bolden. And I'll tell you, we had an event in Topeka. A couple people in this room were at that event in Topeka. We had this event in Topeka in January, and it was awe-inspiring, and unfortunately there's no video recording of it, so it basically didn't happen. But let me tell you something. Michael Bolden had that crowd eating out of the palm of his hand. You know Michael, if you know Michael Bolden, he's from California, you know, like he wears sandals, and, you know, he's drinking kale juice or whatever all day. I mean, he's not the usual Tea Party. Like, you wouldn't immediately say, Michael Bolden, sure, he's in the Tea Party camp over here. But he loves that. He just loves it. So anyway, he had them all riled. He got them eating out of the palm of his hand. It was great, it was great, great. But then, he reeled them in because he said, imagine if we had a state that stood up to the federal government on guns and said, no way, we're not doing it. They're all cheering. Imagine if we had 14 states standing up to the federal government saying, no way, we're not doing it. Cheer. And they passed these bills that say, you have no authority to intervene. Yeah, that'd be great if somebody did that. And then, regardless of all the pressure they were put under, they just kept on defying the law openly. Let's say there's a state where just one city has 1,000 places where you can just defy the law and get the guns you want. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He says, you know what? That heroic moment has already arrived, but not with guns. It was with weed. Yeah. Before I go further, let me assure you, some of you know this about me already, I'm the squariest guy in the whole world. Like, I've never even touched what the squares would call a marijuana cigarette. You can even see in the parking lot, my minivan is out there, okay? So, I mean, you're talking like bourgeois here. But nevertheless, this is a very interesting point. I mean, remember, by the way, when that medical marijuana case went to the Supreme Court in 2005, it was Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama that joined as friends of the court and said, even though we don't agree with California's law, we think they're all a bunch of crazy druggies out there, our view is that this is a federal system. And if California wants a crazy law, that's what the system's about. And so it was interesting to watch these people in this room. They were all ready when it was guns, and then, but by the end of the night, they thought, no, you know what? Darn it, that is how it should be. That's what the United States is. Wouldn't it be chaotic if the states nullified a bunch of different laws? No, you know what it would be? It would be the United States of America. Finally, the last point involves foreign policy. Talk about there being no debate. I mean, Obama and McCain agreeing with each other is like, I couldn't have asked for better, McCain saying that right on the eve of being. But I just talked about this at an event in Iowa. Now, Iowa, of course, a very important state politically. And some of you may know that the Iowa GOP, the top people in the Iowa GOP basically ran the Ron Paul campaign in 08 and 12. And now they're running the Republican Party of Iowa, which I just, it's hard for me not to smile when I see that. So they said, why don't we have Woods come up and do an event where, we had an event in Dubuque, first of all, because they have everything in Des Moines, and everybody in the rest of the state gets grumpy about that. You know, there are people in Iowa who don't live in Des Moines, so we went to Dubuque. And the thought was that I would keynote these events, and this would be a way of kind of spreading this kind of message to these just regular people. Right, who maybe their heart's in the right place, but you know, how are they supposed to know which person they're supposed to listen to on the radio or whatever? So I would go around and talk. So the idea of this event was it was from 1 to 4 p.m., beautiful, convenient, and we had a couple other speakers who spoke briefly, but I spoke three times. Half an hour on the economy, which did not mean a lot of boilerplate about how we need lower taxes. I mean, you know, been there, done that. I gave a talk on the Fed and the bailouts for half an hour. To show that, you know, maybe some of the people you like are not really so good, after all, when the chips are down. It's easy to give a pretty speech, but in 2008, it was hard to be for the free market. Ask if they really were. Secondly, I talked about nullification, and thirdly, I talked about foreign policy. And that foreign policy talk, it's half an hour. I made the case for non-intervention using exclusively conservative arguments. Just making conservative arguments, showing why this is the natural, logical position for you to hold. And when that gets up on YouTube, I'm going to try and spread that as much as I possibly. I was so happy how that came out. Because I knew there were regular mainline conservatives in that room. And I knew, whether they're going to admit it or not, I knew I made them think about this issue. And that's important, because to me, this is the issue of issues. Because it's so many other things are tied into it. Whether it's, oh, I favor lower spending. Okay, well, then you're going to have to come face to face with this issue. Or, you know, I'm interested in civil liberties. Well, you know, when you're running a world empire, there are going to be domestic consequences. And it just goes on. I want financial privacy. I mean, just whatever it is. A lot of it goes back to foreign policy. That's why Ron Paul would often bring up foreign policy in a lot of debates or interviews, because he sees how foundational it is. Well, in particular now, on the foreign policy thing, all we need to do, we don't need to get into a lot of theoretical discussion. Although I did do that. I showed what the link is between the warfare state and government, and how it's hard to have limited government if you're going to have war after war after war. But all we have to do is just look back to recent history. Look at the Iraq war that has now been 10 years. There were people who got so caught up. I mean, these are people who normally, they don't believe a word the federal government says, right? The USDA tells them to do one thing, they do the other. But if the Pentagon tells them something, they just get right in line and absolutely not going to question you, sir.
So people were being told by Tony Blair in England that Saddam Hussein had an unmanned drone program, and his unmanned drones could strike England in 45 minutes. Now, there are people who actually believed that. Now, listen, when I was younger, when I was in the early 90s and late 80s, I bought all the propaganda too, so I'm not saying these are stupid people. Believe me, but for the grace of God go I. I'm not here to criticize those people, but people who should know better, the intellectual class that's forming those minds should have known better. People were believing this. It turns out that, yes, Saddam had an unmanned drone program. The entire program consisted of one prototype made out of plywood and string. Duck and cover, everybody. The drones are coming. The Saddam drones are on their way. But, I mean, you look at the consequences of this war. I mean, the money spent is astronomical. The civilians killed, presumably people who lecture us all day long about moral relativism and we need to believe in absolute moral standards. Presumably some of these people could pause for 3 seconds to think about the so-called collateral damage of anywhere from 100,000 to 1 million innocent people. Like that, maybe that fits into the calculus somewhere. Or anywhere between 2 and 4 million people displaced, a very ancient Christian community completely destroyed, and now Iraq has an Islamic constitution that says all our laws have to be in line with the Quran and now leans toward Iran. In fact, one of their officials recently said the United States has no influence here, and to the contrary, Iran has more or less a veto power over the government. That's what the neocons have to show for themselves. You were unpatriotic, you didn't want that outcome. And then they say, well, now, come on now, we couldn't have, who could have known that we'd have this outcome? Who could have known that this would strengthen Iran? Who could have? Have you never played Risk? Who could have? I knew. Ron Paul. Everybody. Patrick Cannon. Like all these people were saying, this is exactly what's going to happen. Well, gee, let's see. Let's take secular Iraq and let's destabilize it completely. And maybe the people who take over will be like Woodrow Wilson. I, like, who thinks this way? I don't know. And then, meanwhile, of course, the Iran propaganda keeps getting increased again and again. And we look at this, Pat Buchanan had this fantastic column a few weeks ago on the Iran situation. He said, now, before we go insanely ahead into some other thing that's going to be a boondoggle, it's going to enrich some people, not the average person, before we do this again and create a worse disaster, let's put this in perspective. So Pat says, Iran has no missile that can reach us, no air force or navy that would survive the first days of war, no nuclear weapons, no bomb-grade uranium from which to build one. All of her nuclear facilities are under constant United Nations surveillance and inspection. And then he went on to say, does Iran, a Shia island in a Sunni sea, a Persian-dominated land where half the population is non-Persian, a country whose major exports, once we get past fossil fuels, are pistachio nuts, carpets, and caviar, really pose the greatest national security threat to the world's greatest nation? A good question. But the kind of question that isn't even asked in the other two Americas. Not even asked. All this is all taken for granted. All the basic assumptions of the bipartisan foreign policy that we've had since the 1940s are taken for granted by the two so-called alternatives to the third America. And in fact, I've come to the conclusion that maybe the neocons want to encourage radical Islam because every single intervention they've called for has resulted in it. Right? I mean, if you look at, for example, they want to intervene in Syria. Oh yeah, again, I'm sure Woodrow Wilson is going to take power if you intervene in Syria. It's like the mentality is, well, there's a bad guy, so let's put in a good guy, like that's the choice. What usually is there's a bad guy, but there's never a guy so bad that we couldn't come up with a much worse one like him. Which is exactly what happened with Woodrow Wilson in World War I. We don't like that Kaiser. Well, no. But in 1939, anyone in his right mind would have killed to have the Kaiser back. You know, so it's you gotta not live in this crazy utopian fantasy world. And yet, David Frum, the guy who wrote the famous phrase, The Axis of Evil, he wrote a book called An End to Evil. And the conservatives are eating this up. No conservative is supposed to talk that way. Remember how conservatives are supposed to believe that this is a fallen world, and there's only so much you can accomplish, and you have to have modest goals, you can't be utopian, because that's a left-wing thing, and yet they're buying books called An End to Evil. You know, this is, and again, it's not the fault of the average person, it's the fault of the people who are feeding them the information. Sean Hannity is not doing a very good job preserving traditional conservative thinking, and this is leading to all these poor souls, of whom I was one, being misled into neoconservatism. And I was led there because, frankly, I was not a creative enough thinker to see outside the two options. When I was growing up, I thought, well, I don't like Hillary Clinton, so I eliminate her, so I must be Rush Limbaugh. And that was it. I mean, I felt like those are my two choices, so I might as well choose one. But we are the third America. We are the choice. We are the other option. And it's hard to pigeonhole us, and it's funny to watch them try. Well, he's kind of liberal, but he's kind of conservative. No. And in fact, sometimes you hear, like, the Libertarian Party, and God love them, there are many wonderful people in the Libertarian Party, I'm not trying to put them down, but some of those people will say, you want to understand what libertarians are, we are fiscally conservative and socially liberal. No, never say that again. That is a complete misunderstanding. Because that makes it sound like if you believe in freedom, you don't really have a philosophy. You just take some things from these people and take some things from these people, and you're basically an intellectual parasite. But to the contrary, actually, we are the most consistent thinkers there are, because we basically believe in human freedom and all the great potential of human freedom. And what follows from that are all these other things. It's not that, well, I'm kind of this and I'm kind of that. No, we are all one thing. And that all one thing, up to now, there hasn't been room for us on the spectrum. There's only been room for this form of statism and that form of statism. There's no room for somebody who is anti-war but also pro-market. What? Is that even possible? I thought if you were anti-war, you were a commie. Now, actually, the commies, if you look through history, have not really been that anti-war. They're policies. But now there is going to be room for us because we are elbowing our way in. We're forcing our way in to that conversation. You guys are doing it. And then I talk to people at my book table here, and I'm talking to all these people. Well, everybody's got some interesting project going on. It's amazing. Now, I've got some projects that I'm working on I'm very happy about, and you guys have project people are working on. I mean, look at just what one of you can do. Look at what Jeff Frazee did. You know, he starts Students with Ron Paul, then becomes Young Americans for Liberty, and now obviously he has a lot of great help. But he did this, and now it's everywhere. It's astonishing, and every campus has a great story about something it's accomplished. Or I mentioned earlier, Michael Bolden. Michael Bolden was one guy who started the 10th Amendment Center in 2006 during the Bush years. Nobody wanted to hear about the 10th Amendment during the Bush years. Again, if you favor the 10th Amendment under a Republican, you must be a commie of some sort. Right? We have all we could dream of in George W. Bush. What's this guy's problem? And he started this very lonely thing. The 10th Amendment Center was a portion of his apartment in Los Angeles. That was the center. But he worked so hard, he was so productive, that you got the impression that the 10th Amendment Center was this huge, sprawling complex with offices and scholarly fellows in residence and telephone lines. And so he'd get quoted in the New York Times. They'd say, well, according to Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center, which they could have said, according to Michael Bolden of, you know, 28 Elm Street, Los Angeles, right? And now he's got state chapters all over the place. He has helped to put nullification on the map. Everybody calls him. Everybody goes to him. And he was just one guy swimming against the tide against everybody. He had no money. He didn't have any of these fat cat donors, nothing. He was just a guy with an idea. And look at what he did. And he did that because he used every... He worked extremely hard. In fact, he worked so hard that my wife actually tries to intervene sometimes to get him to relax. We don't want him to be dead. He has too much to offer to us. And also, it would be sad. There's a lot more work left in us. But I mean, look at what this guy did. He used the internet. He used everything that was available to him. Because he knows he's not going to get on TV, but he's got YouTube, he has a podcast, he does all this stuff. That is a great model for all of us. We represent the third America, and I am convinced no matter how many tragedies we see, no matter how many face palms when we look at public opinion polls, I truly believe that beneath all of this upper crust of American society, get rid of all that, you look beneath, that the heart that's beating in the real America is the third America. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for listening, everybody. If all goes well, Doug Casey will join us tomorrow. Tune in then.
The Tom Woods Show.